Exposition means facts. The information about setting, biography, and characterization that the audience needs to know in order to follow and comprehend the events of the story. The famous axiom, show, don't tell, is the key. Never force words into a character's mouth to tell the audience about history, world, or person. Rather, dramatize exposition. Dramatized exposition serves two ends. Its primary purpose is to further the immediate conflict. Its secondary purpose is to convey information. The anxious novice often reverses that order, putting expositional duty ahead of dramatic necessity. For example, Jack, dialogue.
Harry, how the hell long have we known one another?
What, about 20 years, huh?
Ever since we were at college together. That's a long time, isn't it, Harry? Well, how the hell are you this morning?
Those lines have no purpose except to tell the eavesdropping audience that Jack and Harry are friends, went to school together 20 years ago, and they haven't had lunch yet. A deadly beat of unnatural behavior. To dramatize exposition, apply this mnemonic principle. Convert exposition to ammunition. Your characters know their world, their history, each other and themselves. Let them use what they know as ammunition in their struggle to get what they want. Jack, reacting to Harry's stifled yawn and bloodshot eyes.
Harry, look at you. The same hippie haircut, the same tie-dyed T-shirts, the same juvenile antics that got you kicked out of school 20 years ago. Are you ever going to wake up and smell the coffee?
The audience's eye jumps across the screen to see what Harry's reaction will be and indirectly hears 20 years and school. Like all else, exposition must have a progressive pattern. Therefore, the least important facts come in early, the next most later, the critical facts last. And what are the critical pieces of exposition? Secrets. The painful truths characters do not want known. Evelyn Mulray's confession, "She's my sister and my daughter," is nothing she would share over cocktails. "You can't kill me, Luke, I'm your father," is a truth Darth Vader never wanted to tell his son. But if he doesn't, he'll have to kill his child. Wait, therefore, for pressure to build on characters and bring the secrets out through honestly motivated action. One way to cope with biographical exposition is to start the telling in the protagonist's childhood and then work through all the decades of his life. The Last Emperor, for example, covers over 60 years in the life of Pu Yi. The story strings together scenes from his infancy when he was made Emperor of China, his teenage years and youthful marriage, his Western education, his fall into decadence, his years as a Japanese stooge, life under the communists, and last, his days as a laborer in Beijing's botanical gardens. However, as convenient as that design may be in terms of exposition, the vast majority of protagonists cannot be followed from birth to death for this reason. Their story would have no spine. In The Last Emperor, the protagonist has a lifelong spine. He is in constant, endless pursuit of an identity. He is a man struggling to find an answer to the question, "Who am I?" But lifelong spines are rare. So we take Aristotle's advice to begin stories en media res, in the midst of things. After locating the date of the climactic event in the protagonist's life, we begin as close in time to it as possible. This design compresses the telling into weeks, days, even hours, and lengthens the character's biography prior to the inciting incident. If you can thoroughly dramatize exposition and make it invisible, if you can control its disclosure, parsing it out only when and if the audience needs to know it, saving the best for last, you're learning your craft. But what's a problem for beginning writers becomes an invaluable asset to those who know the craft. Rather than avoiding exposition by giving their characters an anonymous past,
experienced writers go out of their way to salt their biographies with significant events and create a backstory. Because what is the problem that the storyteller faces dozens of times over in the telling? How to turn the scene. How to create turning points. We can turn scenes only one of two ways, either on action or revelation. There are no others. If, for example, we have a couple in a positive relationship, in love and together, and we want to turn it to the negative, in hate and apart, we could do it on action. She slaps him across the face and says, "I'm not taking this anymore, it's over." Or on revelation. He looks at her and says, "I've been having an affair with your sister for the last 3 years. What are you going to do about it?" Revelations with such power come from the backstory, previous events in the lives of the characters that the writer can reveal at critical moments to create turning points. The flashback is simply another form of exposition. Like all else, it's either done well or ill. In other words, rather than boring the audience with long, unmotivated, exposition-filled dialogue passages, we could bore it with unwanted, dull, fact-filled flashbacks. Or do it well. A flashback can work wonders if we follow the fine principles of conventional exposition. First, dramatize flashbacks. Rather than flashing back to flat scenes in the past, interpolate a mini-drama into the story with its own inciting incident, progressions, and turning point. Although producers often blame flashbacks for slowing a film's pace, and indeed, badly done, they do, a well-done flashback actually accelerates pace. Casablanca. The Paris flashback comes at the opening of Act Two. Rick is crying in his whiskey, drunk and depressed, the film's rhythm deliberately retarding to relieve the tension of the Act One climax. But as Rick remembers his affair with Ilsa, the flashback to the tale of their love affair while the Nazis invade Paris sweeps the film into an ever swifter pace that peaks around a sequence turning point as Ilsa runs out on Rick. Second, do not bring in a flashback until you have created in the audience the need and desire to know. Casablanca. The Act One climax is also the central plot's inciting incident, as Ilsa suddenly reappears in Rick's life and they share a powerful exchange of looks over Sam's piano. There follows a scene of cocktail chat, double entendres and subtext that hint at a past relationship and a passion still very much alive. As Act Two opens, the audience is burning with curiosity, wondering what went on between these two in Paris. Then, and only then, when the audience needs and wants to know, do writers flash back. Voice-over narration is yet another way to divulge exposition. Again, it's done well or ill. Counterpoint narration is Woody Allen's great gift. If we were to cut the voice-over from Hannah and her sisters or husbands and wives, his stories would still be lucid and effective. But why would we? His narration offers wit, ironies, and insights that can't be done any other way. Voice-over to add non-narrative counterpoint can be delightful, but the trend toward telling narration throughout a film threatens the future of our art. It takes little talent and less effort to fill a soundtrack with explanation. Show, don't tell is a call for artistry and discipline, a warning to us not to give in to laziness, but to set creative limitations that demand the fullest use of imagination and sweat. More importantly, show, don't tell means treat the audience as adults. We tell children, we show adults. With respect for the intelligence and sensitivity of our fellow adults, we present our characters' lives and invite the audience to bring their best selves to the ritual, to watch, think, feel, and draw their own conclusions. The misuse and overuse of voiceover is not only slack, it's patronizing. If the trend toward its heavy-handed use continues, especially by talented and privileged artists, cinema will degrade into adulterated novels, and our art will shrivel. Here are a few enduring problems, from how to hold interest, to how to adapt from other media, to how to cope with holes in logic. For each problem, the craft provides solutions. Marketing may entice an audience into the theater, but once in the ritual, it needs compelling reasons to stay in. A story must capture interest. This task is next to impossible unless the design attracts both sides of human nature, intellect and emotion. Curiosity is the intellectual need to answer questions and close open patterns. Story plays to this universal desire by doing the opposite, posing questions and opening situations. Each turning point hooks curiosity. Concern, on the other hand, is the emotional need for justice, strength, survival, love, truth, courage, the positive values of life. As a story opens, the audience, consciously and/or instinctively, inspects the value-charged landscape of world and characters, trying to separate good from evil, right from wrong, things of value from things of no value. It seeks the center of good. Once it finds this core, emotions flow to it. The reason we search for the center of good is that each of us believes that we are good or right, and we want to identify with the positive. Deep inside, we know we're flawed, perhaps seriously flawed, or criminal, but somehow we feel that despite that, our heart is in the right place. The worst of people believe themselves to be good. Therefore, no matter who's in the audience, each seeks the center of good, the positive focus for empathy and emotional interest. At the very least, the center of good must be located in the protagonist. Others may share in it, for we can empathize with any number of characters, but we must empathize with the protagonist. On the other hand, the center of good doesn't imply a Pollyanna notion of niceness. Good is defined as much by what it is not as what it is. From the audience's point of view, good is a judgment made in relationship to or against a background of negativity, a universe that's thought or felt to be not good. The Godfather. Not only is the Corleone family corrupt, so too are all the other mafia families, even the police and judges. Everyone in this film is a criminal or related to one. But the Corleones have one positive quality, loyalty. In other mob clans, gangsters stab each other in the back. That makes them the bad, bad guys. The loyalty of the Godfather's family makes them the good, bad guys. When we spot this positive quality, our emotions move toward it, and we find ourselves in empathy with gangsters. How far can we take the center of good? With what kind of monsters will an audience empathize? Silence of the Lambs. The writers of novel and screenplay place Carice at the positive focal point, but also shape a second center of good around Hannibal Lecter and draw empathy to both. First, they assign Dr. Lecter admirable and desirable qualities, massive intelligence, a sharp wit and sense of irony, gentlemanly charm, and most importantly, calmness. How, we wonder, could someone who lives in such a hellish world remain so poised and polite? Next, to counterpoint these qualities, the writers surround Lecter with a brutish, cynical society. His prison psychiatrist is a sadist and publicity hound. His guards are dimwits. Even the FBI, which wants Lecter's help on a baffling case, lies to him, trying to manipulate him with false promises of an open-air prison on a Carolina island. Soon we're rationalizing. So he eats people. There are worse things. Offhand, I can't think what, but we fall into empathy, musing, if I were a cannibalistic psychopath, I'd want to be just like Lecter. Curiosity and concern create three possible ways to connect the audience to the story: mystery, suspense, dramatic irony. These terms are not to be mistaken for genres. They name story-audience relationships that vary according to how we hold interest. In mystery, the audience knows less than the characters. Mystery means gaining interest through curiosity alone. We create but then conceal expositional facts, particularly facts in the backstory. In suspense, the audience and the characters know the same. Suspense combines both curiosity and concern. 90% of all films, comedy and drama, compel interest in this mode. In suspense, however, curiosity is not about fact, but outcome. In dramatic irony, the audience knows more than the characters. Dramatic irony creates interest primarily through concern alone, eliminating curiosity about fact and consequence. Such stories often open with the ending, deliberately giving away the outcome. When the audience is given the godlike superiority of knowing events before they happen, its emotional experience switches. What in suspense would be anxiety about outcome and fear for the protagonist's well-being, in dramatic irony, becomes dread of the moment the character discovers what we already know and compassion for someone we see heading for disaster. Sunset Boulevard. In the first sequence, Joe Gillis floats dead, face down in Norma Desmond's swimming pool. The camera goes to the bottom of the pool and looks up at the corpse, and voice over, Gillis muses that we're probably wondering how he ended up in a swimming pool. So he tells us. The film becomes a huge flashback, dramatizing a screenwriter's struggle for success. We're moved to compassion and dread as we watch this poor man heading toward a fate we already know. We realize that all of Gillis's efforts to escape the clutches of a wealthy harridan and write an honest screenplay will come to nothing, and he'll end up dead in her swimming pool. Dramatic irony encourages the audience to look more deeply into the motivations and causal forces at work in the characters' lives. This is why we often enjoy a fine film more, or at least differently, on second viewing. We not only flex the often unused emotions of compassion and dread, but freed from the curiosity about facts and outcome, we now concentrate on inner lives, unconscious energies, and the subtle workings of society. However, the majority of genres do not lend themselves to either pure mystery or pure dramatic irony. Instead, within the suspense relationship, writers enrich the telling by mixing in the other two. In an overall suspense design, some sequences may employ mystery to increase curiosity about certain facts. Others may switch to dramatic irony to touch the audience's heart. Suppose you are working on a thriller about a psychopathic axe murderer and a female detective, and you're ready to write the story climax. You've set it in a dimly lit corridor in an old mansion. She knows the killer is near and clicks the safety off her gun as she moves slowly past doors left and right, extending into the dark distance. Which of the three strategies to use? Mystery. Hide a fact known to the antagonist from the audience. Close all the doors so that as she moves down the hall, the audience's eyes search the screen, wondering, where is he? Behind the first door, the next, then he attacks by crashing through the ceiling. Surprise! Suspense. Give the audience and the characters the same information. At the end of the hall, a door is ajar, with a light behind it, casting a shadow on the wall of a man holding an axe. She sees the shadow and stops. The shadow retreats from the wall. Cut two. Behind the door, a man, axe in hand, waits. He knows that she's there, and he knows that she knows that he's there because he heard her footsteps stop. Cut two. The hallway where she hesitates. She knows that he's there, and she knows that he knows that she knows that he's there because she saw his shadow move. We know that she knows that he knows, but no one knows how will this turn out. Will she kill him or he her? Dramatic irony. As Hitchcock might, hide from the protagonist a fact known to the audience.
She slowly edges toward a closed door at the end of the hall. Cut two. Behind the door, a man waits, axe in hand. Cut two. The hallway as she moves closer and closer to the closed door. The audience, knowing what she doesn't know, switches its emotions from anxiety to dread. Don't go near that door. For God's sakes, don't open that door. He's behind that door. Look out! She opens the door and suddenly kisses the man with the axe. Man with axe, dialogue. I've been chopping wood all afternoon, honey. Is dinner ready? That's a false ending, and its dim-witted cousin, cheap surprise. The problem with false endings and cheap surprise is that we go to the storyteller with a prayer. Please let it be good. Let it give me an experience I've never had, insights into a fresh truth. Let me laugh at something I never thought funny. Let me be moved by something that's never touched me before. Let me see the world in a new way. Amen. In other words, the audience prays for surprise, the reversal of expectation. As characters arrive on screen, the audience surrounds them with expectations, feeling this will happen or that will change, Miss A will get the money, Mr. B will get the girl, Miss C will suffer. If what the audience expects to happen happens, or worse, if it happens in a way the audience expects it to happen, this will be a very unhappy audience. We must surprise them. There are two kinds of surprise, cheap and true. True surprise comes from the sudden revelation of the gap between expectation and result. This surprise is true because it's followed by a rush of insight, the revelation of a truth hidden beneath the surface of the fictional world. Cheap surprise takes advantage of the audience. We can always shock the vulnerability of the audience by smash cutting to something it doesn't expect to see or away from something it expects to continue. And in certain genres, horror, fantasy, thriller, cheap surprise is a convention and actually part of the fun. The hero walks down a dark alley. A hand shoots in from the edge of the screen and grabs his shoulder. The hero spins around. It's his best friend. Outside these genres, however, cheap surprise is a shoddy device. Because story creates meaning, coincidence would seem our enemy. For it is the random, absurd collisions of things in the universe and is, by definition, meaningless. And yet coincidence is a part of life, often a powerful part, rocking our existence, then vanishing as absurdly as it arrived. The solution, therefore, is not to artificially avoid coincidence, but to dramatize how it enters life meaninglessly, but in time gains meaning, and how the anti-logic of randomness becomes the logic of life as lived.